My name is Elliot Margioli.
This is Dr. Aaron Judkins.
This is Trey Smith.
This is Ryan Peterson.
This is Dr. Judd Burton.
This is Timothy Albrino.
This is Derek Gilbert, and you're listening to The Dig Bible Podcast.
Glad you made it. Come along for the ride as we search for hidden truth, explore historical context, and dig into God's Word to help us understand the past, present, and future of this supernatural world. This is Steve, along with Justin and Ben, and you are listening to The Dig Bible Podcast.
What is going on, all my local guys and gals and long-distance pals?
We're back.
We are.
We're back, buddies.
We are.
Back live in person.
It's so weird. We don't get together in person very often anymore, and I hate that. I love when we do. It's nice actually sitting across the table from you guys. It's convenient sometimes with guests and things just to be able to do it from home, and honestly just to be able to, you know, turn around and I'm in my kitchen is nice, but you don't get the guy time.
No.
You need the guy time.
You don't get the locker room talk, cigars, and laughs.
That's a true story. It's a true story. We do get some laughs. Most of them are off air.
Yes.
Of course.
Which is good.
My little two clicks.
That was bad. Yeah,
I was taking a starter off of Travis's Jeep when he pulled up. And it was going between the drive shaft and the exhaust. And I could only get two clicks on the ratchet. And the bolt was like 3 inches long. It took forever
to get it off.
Click, click. Click, click. Click, click.
Do you think they have a tool for that?
Well, they probably did, but I was just using a ratchet.
Like a wrist action ratchet for those tight spaces.
You wouldn't
spaces.
Have enough torque on it.
Oh.
It was in there pretty tight.
That would have been a good one for the up-and-coming show, but that's for another time.
Yeah. What? Another show? What are you doing?
Oh, Ben. Ben,
we
is,
ain't really come up with a name yet that I like.
But Ben is.
Things are branching off and not even telling me about it. What?
Ben.
Mutiny.
Ben is doing because I really don't know what I'm doing with most things. I'm figuring life out a little bit late. I figured things out a little bit late in life, but Ben can fix anything. And I've seen him work, I mean, as close to Jesus-like miracles as you possibly can on a car in a matter of seconds. Oh. I mean, it was a step away from water to wine watching that thermostat go in at a car wash. But
on the way to one of the conferences.
On the way to
that
conference.
Yeah, you guys were late. Yeah, I remember.
It literally, yeah. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like that. Blew me away. But Ben.
So it's a vehicle.
It's a vehicle show. It's okay. Going to be.
Well. I guess it's going to be a little bit of everything. We'll do maybe a little gardening stuff, some chicken stuff probably.
Something fun, though.
Yeah, just cutting up, having a good time, working on cars, kind of like a...
Ben Foots DIY.
Yeah, something like that.
DIY.
Is that what it is? Yeah. Oh, do it yourself.
DIY. Yeah. What would that be?
Do yourself it.
Yeah.
Do yourself it.
Do yourself it.
But yeah, I mean, we come up with the idea, and but we ain't, because Steve's father-in-law, he's moving down here sometime, and he's a car guy too.
Yeah.
So we're gonna try to pull him in on it.
I got an episode for you, because my Challenger is in the shop right now getting painted, and I can't find nobody to do my stripes.
So, see, that would be perfect.
I want to order some, like, specialty order vinyl. I want, like, some gray-looking marble. So maybe we can have
Ben
hook me up. Well, yeah. It was the original ones. You remember the original stripes I had?
They're about half, like, I think.
Okay.
Older than that.
Down the side. Yeah.
Down the whole length of the car.
Yeah, okay. That would look cool.
I tell you what, he's even done a lot of hand striping. You know, the way it was done. The way it was done originally.
Pin striping with hand, you know, by hand.
Yeah, where they take their hand, they take the other hand and rest it on the wrist.
Just, yeah. Oh, yeah, that guy is gifted. Once again, I'm around another person who knows how to do stuff and I don't. And I just get to sit and watch and be like, that's cool. I wish I could do something.
It'll be interesting. We got to come up with a name. One of them was called like the one idea is called the Three Nut Garage. Cause it's going to be funny. We're going to cutting up and everything. And where Steven don't really know a lot. I said, you know, like it could be like I could be a wing nut, the logo, like a wing nut, and then like maybe a lug nut, and then acorn.
And an acorn.
Yeah. That pretty much sums me up right there.
It's Steven's acorn.
Let's just say you don't want to call me to work on your car.
Eventually. Give it about 2 years and you'll be all right.
You work on the physical body, not the automobile body.
That is true. That is true.
You're a doctor, man.
No, I don't work on my own body. Are you kidding me?
Oh, okay. Sorry. It'll be interesting. We'll see how it goes.
It'll be fun.
Stay tuned.
Yeah. It will definitely be a little bit different pace than what we do right now.
It'll
be for you to laugh.
Yep.
But also learn.
Yeah. Just a fun show. We'll keep it obviously kid friendly and everything, you know, obviously, but it'll be fun.
Three nuts. Planting gardens, fixing bodies, and two clicking transmissions.
That's a lot of words.
I'm not putting that on a shirt, I'll tell you that.
No. Which our little, you know, group text I put like to party, like off of Hot Rod, the movie. That movie's hilarious. I like to party. You don't party. No one can party but me. I like to party.
I always think of when you say that, just that movie Jackass popped in my mind where the guy was in Japan. You remember? He just in Japan, they're all. He's like, hey, you know what? I want to party. I like to party. And he'd just rip off his clothes.
Yeah, they have like a boom box with some beats. Yeah. And just start dancing.
Yeah, and he would be naked, but he had a pair of just like whitey-tidy underwear and a bow tie. And he would dance and grind all over these Japanese people. And they're all like, oh, God.
Yeah, they're like, oh, my goodness, no.
I like to party.
We don't like to party that much.
No,
I think there's probably a lot of drugs involved in making of that show.
Oh, definitely.
There would have to be some of the stuff they did.
Shooting firecrackers out of their butts.
Yeah, no.
That's real snakes bite their other snakes.
Yeah.
I actually seen that in the $5 bin at Walmart like a month or two ago.
You bought it?
I did. And it had like all four of them. There was like three or four of them, and I actually watched them. And
some of them are really messed up over
it. I really did. Yeah. I had to turn it off because it was like some of it was just gross, and the other parts of it was just really like, I mean, it was just offensive.
It's funny, but yeah.
What shows you, though, is that if you go back, say, for me, 10 years ago, the things that I watched, the things that I thought were entertaining, have changed a lot because you sit there and think and you watch it now. And then you get to a point too, where you have kids and you sit down, you're like, oh, let's watch this movie. And you're like, we watched, we turned a movie at my wife's like, let's watch, you know, some of these 80s movies we like, you know, used to love to watch. And we turned on Breakfast Club. Remember Breakfast Club?
Yeah.
And there's that part where, Judd Nelson like gets under the table and he's like, reaching up the girl's skirt, and you're like, oh my God, turn it off, the kids can't see it, no, like, you don't even realize, I don't remember this stuff, and then you sit there, and you think about it through, like, the eyes that we have now, and you're sitting there going, that's not okay,
no,
like, that's not okay, like, I can't have my kids watching that, but you know, when we watched it, you know, probably the first time I watched that movie was probably 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. But you just didn't.
Either it wasn't offensive or it just went over your head. There's been several instances I went back and watched an old movie and it had so many, like, jokes or
adult references where a kid wouldn't get it.
Exactly. And I was like, dude, I don't remember that. But they do. It's like, or at least they did back then, they would insert some adult humor, but it was kind of hidden and masqueraded so the kids wouldn't pick it up and only the adults would. It was kind of like a esoteric inside joke for the adults.
It was something to keep the adults' attention too, I guess.
Yeah.
Watching a movie with their kids or so.
Yeah, it just blows me away though, because you just, this, you know, think about TV and how that stuff is slowly, it's gotten worse over time. If I go back and watch the A-Team, which was my favorite show, and it still is, just gonna be totally honest with you. A-Team was awesome. Ben, you could have been in the A-Team. Mr. T could, in 5 minutes, bulletproof a van, make a grill that dropped and machine guns came out the front. In like 10 minutes, he was done. You could do that. I've seen you do stuff like that. I mean, not quite to that level, but
those shows were. I do not have machine guns.
In your grill.
In my grill.
But if you think about it, you go back to those shows, things were different. Like, it was, even shows like that where they shot, you know, a million rounds in a show.
Didn't shoot nobody.
Nobody got hurt. And it was still,
and they never,
like,
had to change clips.
Yeah.
No, never.
Well, see, I got some of them too. It's infinity round clips.
But once in a while, they'd take it off and be like, hey, I got one shot left. And then 37 shots later, they're still going. But you think those shows were still, to some degree, I say wholesome. There was a good message. They were people who were, you know, wrongly accused of something that were trying to help people. They were trying to do what was right, even though they were in a bad predicament. So that even in a show like that, there was a good moral high ground. Come forward another 30 years, 40 years to now, because that was the 80s. You know what I mean? Come forward to now.
Right.
Think about the TV show. Garbage. Where's the moral high ground?
There ain't none.
Where is the, even if there is adversity and all this thing and what they're pushing, it's a sexual agenda. It's all these things that we see. It's unbelievable. The stuff that they're feeding our kids, you know, subconsciously, and that we're taking this stuff, our kids are taking this stuff, and it becomes part of the, well, it's just what it is. It's the norm, and we're okay with it. And we've slowly over time, we get indoctrinated into the culture that we're in. I'm going to do this. I'm sorry. I know we're way off topic. I got to look this up. I had this and I pulled it up. We had an internet incident, so we don't have internet right now. But do I have the verse?
Thank you, Storm.
Oh, crap. I'm probably not going to have it. Anyway, I put it up on Facebook, and it's in, I think, 2 Timothy, and it talks about how, you know, people of the culture will listen to whoever they want to hear, what they want to hear. And I know I'm
radiate, don't assimilate.
That's what I pulled. I put it into that episode there.
See, I listen.
And that was something that you sit there and I think about what's happening right now is that the church as a whole, and I'm not saying every church, I'm not saying everybody in the church, but if you look around, look what just happened with the United Methodist Church. Did you see that in the news?
I don't watch the news.
It come up on Facebook. It come up everywhere. It came up on Facebook for me first. So then I went and I had to search it because Facebook, you can't, you know, independently fact check, you know, blah, 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 whatever. But the United Methodist Church okayed gay marriage and they okayed homosexual preachers. They lost over 1 million members the first day that they put that through. But this is, the church is going through and changing things based on our culture, not on our biblical views. We're saying, we're assimilating and allowing these things in and changing for the culture. Oh, you know what? That's not that bad. So we're going to accept that.
Appeasing everybody.
Well, we do, but we rationalize certain sins.
Well, yeah. What is it Tom Dunn said? If you can't crucify it, you justify it.
You justify it. Yeah.
That's right.
And that's exactly what's happening. So the church is going that direction. We're seeing this huge, and the funny thing is I posted that. I think it was either the same day or the day after that happened. I didn't even know that had happened. But that I read that night and I'm like, man, I can see this happening. We see the church following cultural beliefs rather than biblical beliefs. And once again, gross generalization. There, a lot of the church is great, and they're focused.
See, a lot of them are pulling away. Or,
well, there's a big separation.
I've heard that they have to. I was talking to a guy, and he was talking about this, and he said that a lot of these churches, I guess, where the main United Methodist Conference or whatever you want to call it, kind of help certain churches with money to keep them afloat or whatever. That the churches, if they want to separate, they have to buy their way out of.
And there was 66 of them. I think it was 66 within. I think it's Southern Alabama and that panhandle of Florida that are trying to break 66 churches that were trying to break away, but they all have to do this.
Yeah, they got to pay so much
and
money.
If it's a small church,
they don't have the money to do it.
I could be a little bit off on the numbers and things like that, but just say that this we're seeing the church bend to these cultural so-called norms that we are, you know, half the things that are happening right now, the gender identity stuff that we're seeing in our culture right now, that's becoming the norm, you know, Bruce Jenner and all this other stuff that has happened. We see this, what's happening right now. And we went from that being in the DSM, which is the book of psychiatric disorders.
Yep.
That is a psychiatric disorder. And now we're glorifying it. He won an SP for like person of the year or whatever, because how brave he was.
And is it Gay Pride Month? I've been seeing stuff like that on Facebook.
For June is...
Yeah, Ricky from the Christian Theological Dark Web, he posted some shirts that he's made, and it's got the big rainbow on the front of it and then a Nephilim skull. And it says, Nuke the Nephilim Month. Talking about the Genesis 6 and, you know, and all that. And I had messaged. I said, that's funny. I said, I want one. I said, but I want the Nephilim skull to have a mohawk and a rainbow mohawk. And then at the bottom of it say, Strange Flesh Month.
Wow.
So I think, you know, we might need to be working on some shirts. Strange Flesh Month. A rainbow mohawked Nephilim skull.
It is just, it's blowing me away how we are rationalizing things. And I've said this before, and I'll stand by everything that I've said. And if I find out later that something I said is inaccurate or wrong, I'll 100%, you know, come clean on that and say, yeah, I was wrong on this, this, or this. But I've said this a bunch of times, is that when it comes to people choosing alternative lifestyles or whatever, picking their gender or all these things that we're seeing happening right now, God still loves those people. I love those people. Do I agree with what they're doing? Absolutely not. I don't agree with it. But technically, I was born sinful just like them. I have sinned just like they've sinned. The difference is that I've asked Jesus to wipe that away. We're all sinful. I've asked Jesus to wipe that away. That's the only difference. There's no sin that you can't come back from. It says in the Bible, the only thing that's the only unforgivable sin is rejecting the Holy Spirit. That's like not asking the Holy Spirit to live in you. Of course you're not going to heaven then.
Yep.
So it's a sad thing that we see in our culture, that people are accepting these things as the norm. It does not. Listen, I love everybody. I have numerous friends that live alternate lifestyles, and I love those people. Do I agree with them? No. Have I had these conversations with a lot of them? Yes, I have. And I'll say, this is what I believe. In the end, I'm not the judge of you. James says there is one lawmaker and there is one judge. That's God. At the end of time, that is when you will have to stand in front of him and say, this is why I did this, and this is right or wrong. You'll be judged for what you've done on earth. And I want you to know, I'm not worried about what you've done, because I'm more worried about what I've done. I sit there and I know that God's forgiven me, but I still dread the day that I got to sit there and say, yeah, I did that. So think about those things. Think about, you know, we love everybody. We don't sit there. I'm not going to sit there and judge and say, oh, you're going to hell. You're a terrible person. That's not my job. My job is to show you love, show you Christ through my actions, try to show you Christ in how I live, which I do fail at times. I'm not going to say I don't, but I'm going to try to show you Christ in everything I do. And if you want to talk about it, let's talk about it. But in the end, God is the judge, and you'll have to stand in front of him at some point in your life. And if you're sitting there and you're ever questioning, is this right or wrong? Am I feeling a nudge or something's eating you up? Or you feel the right that you have to defend something all the time? That's probably Jesus knocking on your heart saying, hey.
Yeah.
Hey.
I'm letting you know this ain't right.
So, I mean.
Change it. Fix it. Do something.
I love everybody and I want everybody. I wish everybody would end up in heaven. I know that's not the case. But
that's what we're trying to do, though.
One person at a time. Now, what we say is empty out, populate heaven and empty out hell. But this may be a surprise to anybody listening to this. This is not our topic today at all.
No. Nope.
We just went way off, and I apologize.
We've not even did the prayer.
And we're 20 minutes in.
It's all right. Obviously, it needed said.
There are days, you know, you have to let the Holy Spirit lead the.
Yep, that's what we do.
Lead the conversation. So why don't I pray?
Sounds good.
Dear Lord, thank you for everything you've given us. Thank you for this time we have together. Thank you for all these blessings that we do not deserve. We have so much, and you've given us so much, and we don't deserve any of it. Our salvation, our lives, the people around us that love us, it's all blessings from you. Just help us reach out and reach that one person that needs to hear this message, that needs to hear you, that needs to feel that knock on their heart. Just reach out, and if it's not one, if it's 100, reach those 100. Reach whoever needs to hear this message. Lord, be there, knock on their heart, and you know, hope we can plant that seed. Amen.
Amen.
So what's your topic today, Mr. Justin?
Today's topic is world civilizers and how we see through every culture, every time period, every continent, all have similar themes and stories about a great cataclysm and these people showing up with all this divine wisdom and giving it to humanity for their betterment and to civilize humanity. So we're going to take a look at all these different cultures and people groups and compare their mythologies and their histories and see how they stack up and filter through the biblical narrative.
All yes. Right. I love it. I always love this when we can sit here and take these things. And we did a little bit on it, that last one, talking about the pantheons a little bit. And this is kind of, you know, it's kind of a front runner to that. But
deeper dive.
It is a deeper dive. And there's more. I mean, and let's be honest. At this table, you got the brains. So
where are they?
I got the bronze.
You got the bronze. I, like I told you, I'm good for nothing. But the I just love this, and when I was looking at this, the I found the study of this actually was called comparative mythology, and I really never really thought about that. But I was just looking at that, and I thought it was really cool because every one of these things that we see, the Bible has answers for. It just blows me away every time I have a question. The Bible answers it for me.
But oh yeah.
I defer to you because this is one of your passions. This is one of the things you've been diving into a lot. So
which I love history. I love mythology. So definitely I love looking at how we have the same story, but just different names and different places. I just absolutely love that. And like you said, it all filters through the Bible, and the Bible has the answer. And I'm not going to beat a dead horse here. If you are a listener or follower of our work and what we do, you are well familiar with the Genesis 6 fallen angel narrative and the Book of Enoch. You know, we're going through this Book of Enoch study currently right now. So what do you have there, just, you know, 30,000 foot view? You have fallen angels coming down, breeding with the daughters of men, and giving knowledge, wisdom, you know, as Gary Wayne says, the seven sacred sciences to humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we're going to look at, but deeper dive at these different cultures. And one of the first places that I wanted to go to was Mexico. So, and we could do a whole mini series on this, 2 hours long, 50 episodes, but we're going to hit the high notes and ones that kind of stood out to us, and just kind of highlight some of this stuff for you guys. And T ends up, and hopefully you can go and do your own deep dives and discover some more. And if you do, hit us up. Shoot us an email, thedig423@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And if there's other topics or mythologies or things that you would like to hear about, let us know, and we'll dive into those things. But when we go to Mexico, we have a pyramid called Quicquelgo. And that's my redneck way of saying it. So, you know, I'm sure there's some rolling of the Q's and R's, but Quicquelgo. And for those that want to look this up, it's spelled C-U-I-C-U-I-L-O. But this is near Mexico City. And in 1519, the Spanish soldiers found this, and the locals said that they did not build it, that the giants had built this, and they found this site. But when they built it for the in honor of the rain god called Tlaloc. And they said that Tlaloc sent a great flood to destroy them, and that only seven survived. You know, fearing a second flood, built this pyramid with the help of a giant from the Chinametzin tribe, which is a known giant tribe from Mexico. But what's fascinating is, if it's not fascinating enough and just throwing out flares into the air for you, this is the biblical narrative of the flood and the Tower of Babel. So, but after this flood, a stranger comes from the east by a boat with no paddles, and it was said to be carried by serpents. It said that he and his followers taught them how to grow crops, domesticate animals, gave laws, instructed them in the ways of architecture, astronomy, and arts, and they worshipped him as a god. Once again, Genesis 6 and the Book of Enoch, all over again, just in a different place with different names. But he was betrayed by his followers to a Mexican war god called Huitzilopochtli, who wielded a fiery serpent. And when this happened, he sailed away back toward the east from where he came, but promised to return. And he was described as a white-bearded man with a long robe. And this was none other than Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent. So this is why the people never put up a fight when the Spanish conquistadors showed up. Here comes the Spanish conquistadors, white, big old beards, shining armor, on boats coming from the east. They thought that this was their god returning. I thought that was just wild.
Yeah, that's a cool correlation. Not so much for them,
right?
But pretty cool correlation, considering all they really wanted was their gold. But hey, you know.
Yeah.
What do you do?
And do you guys remember hearing that in school? I remember hearing it in school, but I just never thought nothing about it. They just kind of skimmed over it. You know, in history, they were like, oh, yeah, there was a god that was depicted as shining, and here they show up with their armor, and they just never put up a fight and just gave them everything. And then the Spanish turned around and killed them all and enslaved them. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense. There was, as usual, there was so much more to the story.
That actually sounds very similar to a when you talk about the Book of Enoch, it's history always repeats itself. It's the same thing that happened in the Book of Enoch when we talk about when the children of the Watchers, when the Nephilim, it said they ate everything and consumed everything, and then they took over and made the people do everything for them to the point where they eventually ate the people.
Yeah.
Like, they took everything from them. It gets to that point. Ooh.
So if you're in Mexico and we just go a little further south, we arrive in South America. Well, in this legend, history, mythos, you know, whatever you want to call it, it says that all was darkness and nothing existed, and that he came forth from the waters of Lake Titicaca. And it said that he created everything, and that it took him 3 tries to create humanity. You know, that he made a race of giants, a race of dummies, and then finally he successfully made intelligent human beings. So I think that this is talking about not necessarily a creation, but a recreation after a great cataclysm. Because it says he comes from the waters of Lake Titicaca. So could this be after the great flood? Or what history is saying, the young Adrias event where these asteroids hit the earth and caused this huge meltback and caused all the waters and sea levels to rise. And the reason why I say that is because we have the same exact narrative as Quetzalcoatl in Mexico. Because when you go down, it says he too had a set of followers or disciples called the Veracochan. This god, But he had a set of followers and disciples called the Veracochan, and this god is none other than Veracocha himself. But this is almost a carbon copy of Quetzalcoatl. He too is described as a bearded and robed white figure. So, if you look at that, Mexico and South America, those people, you never see them with beards. They can't, it's just in their DNA. They can't grow beards, and they're dark-skinned people. So, this is definitely describing foreigners. This is not indigenous people that they're talking about here. And studying some of Brian Forrester's work, he talks about this thing called the Path of Veracocha. And man, I thought this was fascinating, because the way the myths describe when he comes out of Lake Titicaca, it talks about the first town he goes to. And he is a civilizer, and him and his disciples and followers taught them how to add, how to grow crops in their seas and architecture, all the world civilizing things that we hear from Quetzalcoatl. But he travels from town to town, making his way across the continent. And what's funny is when you go to these cities, every single one that is listed has huge megalithic architecture. here's where we have all these pyramids and all these just grand buildings. And without fail, every single one of these sites, they have found elongated skulls.
Ed the Head? Ed the Head?
Ed the Head, yeah. I don't have him.
I know.
And what's crazy is, yeah, you do have, you know, cranial deformation happening. And this is where people would squish the heads to make them elongated. But there's telltale signs. When you see that, it makes flat spots in the brain or in the skull. It also doesn't increase the brain case volume. It doesn't get rid of the Saddra Sutra line. And also where the spine mounts to the head, it doesn't change that position at all. On some of these skulls that they're finding, they don't have Saddra Sutra lines. This spine, where it attaches to the head, they call it the cranius magnum. They are all the way at the back of the skull. So if you put this on a normal head, they would just be staring down at their chest all the time. So this showed that they had to have a longer neck and stronger neck muscles to support this elongated, heavy head that was mounted at a non-centered position. And all these head bindings that we find, they're all dead center. They've not moved. So that doesn't change that. And on top of that is that the brain case volume is larger in some of these that they're finding. And not only that, the eye orbits are 25 to 30% larger. So this is something other than human. This is a hybrid race.
But the sagittal suture, like you're talking about, on so when a human child, right, you have those multiple different suture because you don't have a solid skull when you're born, so that you can come through the birth canal. The way that those skulls set up without that sagittal suture, would you, whoever is giving birth to that, would have to be either a giant to be able to pass that, or whoever was giving birth would have died. If it was a human woman, she would have died giving birth. It would have torn her apart. So it makes a big difference. I mean, that's why we're built. That's why God made us the way he did, is so that the way that our skull forms after it comes through, that heals together after. That's why you can see when you look at a human skull, you can see those suture lines, because what happens is they heal together over time. Like a baby's, you know, that's why I don't drop a baby on the head. You know, it's
the soft spot.
The soft spot. It's that thing though that has to cover up and has to heal together. But if you don't have that ability, then whoever gave birth, if it was a human, say it was the Genesis 6 event, and this is an angel having intercourse with a woman, and she gives birth. If this was an elongated skull at that point, if the Nephilim truly had that, those women most likely would not have survived the birth. So.
Yeah. And they have actually found infants, you know, and fetuses mummified with these elongated heads also. So showing that they were born this way. And it goes back to imitation. Everybody started getting the mullets a few years ago. What were they imitating? Morgan Wallen come out with the mullet. Next thing you know, everybody wanted to be like him and imitate him. So now everybody started getting the mullet. And that's what these elongated heads and this headboarding and binding was. These Viracochans, these quote-unquote gods, the ruling class that came down and taught them all this knowledge, they were trying to imitate the gods.
So interesting you say that too, because we see this on multiple continents.
Yes.
Doing the same thing. And I'm sure you're going to get there, so I'll leave that alone. But I just think it's interesting you see these things in different parts of the world, on opposite sides doing the same things, imitating the same likenesses. And I mean, you keep going. Mm. I don't want to jump too far ahead.
Yeah, but the way the story ends is just like Quetzalcoatl, that he and his followers left by walking on water out to sea and warned of false returning Viracochas. So here we have either these fallen entities imitating Christ that's coming by walking on the water, warning of Antichrist or anti-Viracochans. Or another possibility, if we're being realistic, was the Christians that came, their culture rubbed off onto the people and their myths, and possibly an archetype figure of Christ kind of got woven into this character known as Viracocha.
I think you're right, because I think if you look at that, and even if you go into, you know, Acts, the book of Acts in the Bible, it talks numerous times about asking Paul if he's the are you the Egyptian, you know, that led the last revolt, because they, you know, another guy coming saying he's the Messiah, mm-hmm. saying that he's this person. And then when they're in the temple, I think it's Ananias is sitting there when they bring in the disciples, and he goes, look, we've had this happen before. Somebody rises up, they get a bunch of followers, it later dies off later on. So we see these imitations happening before Christ. So that's not a stretch at all to say that, because this has been foretold, you know, the Genesis 3:15. We know this is coming. So that, and believe me, if we knew it was coming, then the powers that be, the evil principalities, knew this was coming.
Mm-hmm.
They want to imitate this. They want to somehow take it and steer the narrative so that they say, well, look, he's saying this is going to happen. Let's take it and use it to our advantage. And we see it play out time and time and time again. So,
yeah, who's to say that the God that's above all time, space, and matter allowed them to do this, but for his glory and his benefit, so that these people, when they did hear about Christ, was more willing to accept because it was a familiar story.
Yeah. I think, like I said, we can't fathom God and what God does and how God puts things together, because hindsight, you know, we always say is 20/20, but you can see these things that happen that are terrible. You think about the flood happened. I mean, you think Noah's sitting there. I can't imagine what Noah went through. Like, you're sitting here, you're watching all of humanity, everything that lived on Earth that's not in your boat is dead. It's
bouncing against the boat.
And bodies.
Yeah.
You always bring that up. You're so morbid.
What? I mean, it's, you know,
but it happened. Bodies bouncing off the boat.
Well, you know it happened.
And people are trying to climb up the side.
I mean,
and stuff,
not even
drowning.
Just humans. It'd be animals, everything.
It is just a very crazy thing to think about. But, yeah.
Hmm. Well, next we're going to go to the Greeks. And this one kind of hits close to home. We're going to talk about Prometheus.
Ooh.
And this is one thing, too, that I've already caught some flack from some
people.
Do
you know what your show's named after?
I know, right? It's like, guys, come on. If I'm going to do a podcast and name my podcast after something, I'm sure there's a lot of idiots out there, but I'm not one of them, okay? I've looked into it. I know all about it. So, obviously, you need to maybe, if you're confused, ask, hey, what do you mean by this title, you know? And which I've explained it, but, you know, some people are. They're quick to jump to conclusions.
No.
So
there's nobody like that.
Yeah. So, once again, I use the Prometheus lens as an allegory to take a second look at everything. And Prometheus, a.k.a., can be a Christ figure or a Satan figure. It's all on your perception and how you see him. But if the prince of the power of the air, Satan, is masquerading as Prometheus, number one rule of war, as we say, know thine enemy. So if you have the perspective or the lens of the enemy, then you will not be deceived. So there you go, caveat before I get started.
I think it's good. I think it's good that you explain it. And sometimes you got to explain things multiple times. Somebody might not have heard a different episode, you know, of the Prometheus lens that you talked about that. So I think it's good. And if you haven't listened to it, jump on it. If you like this kind of material, this is a lot of what Justin covers on there. So,
but for those that's not familiar, because I just don't want to, you know, just jump straight into it. Prometheus, that his famous story is that he steals fire, which was symbolic for the knowledge and the wisdom from Zeus, and gave it to humanity. So on one end of the coin, the Christ figure, he is the one that is the benefactor of mankind and is crucified, chained to a rock to have his liver and eyes plucked out for all eternity, and they would grow back every night by an eagle. So he suffered and was sacrificed for the better of humanity. And on the opposite side, he is the divine rebel against God, Satan. So in this story, his name actually means forethought, Prometheus. But a lot of people don't know, but he also had a brother named Epimetheus, which means afterthought.
I thought that was Postmetheus.
No. Postmetheus.
Postmetheus.
So here, you know, more allegorical stuff. You know, you got somebody that's smart and thinks about things ahead of time, and then you have the dummy that just acts and then thinks about his actions afterwards. So
I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
Lord, I apologize.
Yeah. So, but I'm going to tell you a story here that's not so commonly known to the masses, unless you just kind of geeked out on Greek mythology and looked into this stuff. But there is actually a flood story with the Greeks. So the way the story goes is Prometheus steals the fire and he pisses off Zeus, right? So Zeus automatically has it out for him. He has to even the score. So Prometheus actually has a human Nephilim son. And his name was King Decleon. Well, with the gift of fire, humanity was doing really good. But they were making a lot of noise, disturbing the gods. With their newfound knowledge, they were becoming more rebellious. They wasn't honoring the gods as much and sacrificing and worshiping like they used to. And with Prometheus upsetting Zeus already, he already had his son in the crosshairs and humanity in the crosshairs. So Zeus pays Prometheus back through his stupid brother, Epimetheus. Zeus has Hephaestus, which was the forge god of the Olympians. He was the one that made all the divine weapons. He's the one that made the thunderbolt for Zeus and all this stuff. Well, Zeus has him create the perfect woman and has all the gods give her a gift, a piece of themselves.
Just so you know, I married her.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I thought I married her. And you ain't married to my wife.
No. I'm married to mine. She's okay. The perfect one. All right, anyway, go ahead.
No, so,
no.
I don't want to miss an opportunity. I'm sorry.
But all these gods give her a divine gift to make her this perfect woman. And they name her Pandora. And Pan means all. So she had all the gifts. Well, she gives Pandora, or he gives Pandora to Epimetheus as a wife. And on the wedding night, he gives Pandora a gift. And he gives her this box. And it's gold, has all these jewels and inlays. It's just a beautiful box. And this is the famous Pandora's box. Well, the way the story goes is when he gave it to her, he said, under no circumstances are you to open this box. So she had it laying next to her bed. But every night the box would whisper to her, Pandora, open me, open me. And she kept resisting. Well, after so long, she finally gives in and she opens the box. And out comes all these demonic spirits. War, pestilence, famine, just all this, these bad things that corrupt earth come out of this box. And she hurries up and slams the box. But it's already been done. They're loose. So humanity already has the wisdom and the knowledge. They're already being rebellious, getting on Zeus's nerves. Now these demons are going around, and it says that earth was just chaotic and turmoil. Well, then another voice comes whispering from the box. Pandora, open me. Pandora, open me. And she's like, no way. You know, you done got me once. And it keeps talking to her, and it says, I'm a good spirit. If you let me out, I am hope. I will fight the evil, you know, and all this stuff. So at this point, she's like, I've already screwed the pooch. How else, you know, how worse could it get?
Sorry, messed up.
Yeah. So she opens the box, and out comes hope. So there's where you get the duality of light and dark and the battle of good and evil. Well, with earth fully corrupt, and once again we go back to Genesis 6, Zeus decides to destroy all life with a flood, thus taking back the fire and killing Prometheus' offspring.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I think that's cool, though. It's, you know, it's saying taking back the fire, taking back the knowledge. So the people who are corrupt, the people that had the knowledge that came from that, you know, we, once again, the Bible only talks about, gives us that like 8 or 9 verses that lead us up from the fallen angels to the flood. But the book of Enoch gives us more in depth than that. And I have to say this, we know Book Enoch's not canon, but it's, to me, it's a good history book, and it tells us some things. And whether it happened exactly like that or not, when you can see this and that picture painted around the world, and the fact that and the Jewish people, you know, this was a big part of their writings at that time. And I talked about that with Qumran, that when they went and found the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes that were at Qumran, who wrote most of the scrolls that were in Qumran, right? They would write what they called peshers. And a pesher is a commentary. And they would do that on all the books of the Hebrew Bible.
Like the Midrash, like the priests used to do. You
know? Exactly. And they did that on the book of Enoch. They wrote that. They only did that for things that they deemed that important. The Essenes had a pesher on the book of Enoch. Jude quotes it. We've said this stuff over and over again, but I just think it's important to say that there is biblical reason to look at Enoch. So,
yep. And also, with that Greek flood myth, Prometheus comes down, warns his son, the king, to build a boat and grab the animals and the plants and the seeds so they could be sustained. So, another carbon copy, same story, different names.
It is crazy when you can see how that all fits together.
Now this one you're going to really like, because this one was something I knew of this god and the baseline of the story, but once I got to digging a little bit, I actually found a lot of new nuggets on this one.
You were what?
Digging. Digging, baby. I ain't no county worker, being.
You're not just standing there holding the shovel.
Praying for a hole.
You're actually using the shovel.
That's right. But this one is the Sumerian Tales and Enki. So Enki was the Lord of the Abyss, which was, you know, symbolic for the waters, the chaos. But his father was Anu, the sky god. And his mother was, you know who his mother was? Nama. Or Nama.
Oh, actually, I did. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I did know that.
So.
Interesting choice of names.
Yeah. Lamech's daughter, who was beautiful and comely. But that's what I had in there. You know, Genesis, Nama, ? Oh, yeah. And for those that are just joining us and don't know or not familiar, in the Genesis 10, you get the genealogies. And that's all men, typically. But in Lamech's children's line, amongst all the boys, you get this girl named Nama. And her name in Hebrew translates as comely and beautiful, which was the same description of the women that the angels came down and took for wives, because they were comely and beautiful. And then this knowledge that they taught them. Well, then these sons listed have all of the divine knowledge from the book of Enoch. One was a master of forging and building weapons. One was a master of herdsmen and animals. And then the other one was a master of
music. It was the lyre and the harp.
Yeah. So here we have, coincidence, maybe, I think not, but you have these heavenly knowledge, forbidden knowledge, whatever you want to label it, that was taught from the fallen angels, these three boys being sudden masters of these arts. And here's a daughter of Lamech, which was their sister, with the same name as the descriptor of the women that the fallen angels took. So it appears as the brothers traded their sister off to the fallen angels for this wisdom and knowledge. And here in this epic is the same name we see pop up again. But there's another name coming that sounds just like it, but just a little twist. So maybe this is the same root name and just a different, you know, variation. But so Nama or Nama was the mother of Enki, the way the story goes. But once again, I hate to keep sounding like a broken record, but this is how these stories are. The gods grew tired of digging rivers and tilling the land. They were constructing the earth. So they decided to create humans to do the work for them. Enki and his sister Ninma started experimenting and making humans and splicing and mixing DNA. Enlil was Enki's brother, and he was the elder brother. He was the quote-unquote alpha male. And he was kind of the domineering oppressor, and he wanted to rule over humanity and have them just dumb slaves. Just smart enough to do the work, nothing more. Ninma was to marry her brother Enlil. She was promised to him. But she fell in love with Enki. As they were working together, they grew close, sparks flew. So together, they created humanity, and Enki, the one that was described as the keeper of the wisdom and the knowledge, he was the wise one, taught Ninma all of the hidden knowledge of the heavens. And against the will of Anu and Enlil, they taught humanity the secrets of the gods and created an intelligent race. So here, once again, you have this fallen angel or God, whatever label you want to put, that has all this divine knowledge hooks up with this woman, Nima, different variation of the same name, sounds like.
Cognate.
Yeah. Taught her the forbidden knowledge, and she passes it on to her creations. So, once again, same story coming on down. What happens? This new intelligent race are no longer the dumb slaves just doing all the dirty work. They start making tools. They start, you know, making instruments, playing music, started becoming more independent, not relying on the gods as much and sacrificing to them, and started making all this noise. So it says in the story they became too loud and independent, and Enlil ordered a great flood to destroy his brother and his sister's creations. Enki comes down and warns one of his devout followers named Atrahasis and tells him to what? To build a boat for he and his family. He is another Prometheus figure and giver of knowledge and another world civilizer. And what's funny is he's also like an archetype of Odin, because Enki, like Odin, often was depicted that he walked amongst his people and his creations in disguise as an old man teaching as he went. And he also had a lower class of gods that were followers, just like Quetzalcoatl, Viracocha.
Divine Council.
Yeah. They had his own disciples and followers. And these guys were known as the Apkallu sages. They were depicted as half fish men. Sometimes they had bird heads. But it's almost like they were signaling to us that, you know, these guys just swam right through the flood or the abyss of chaos and brought the knowledge to humanity.
I think that's the Apkallu stuff always, I think that's just so cool, but it makes you wonder about, and once again, this is just speculation, of course, like you said, swim through the flood. And we've talked about that before. You know, it says everything, you know, was destroyed. Everything was killed. Everything was, but if anything could make it through the flood, it would have to be something that could live in the water. It would have to be some kind of, half fish, half man. If it was something, and if you go further back into the book of Enoch or the book of Jasher or Jubilees, and it talks about the corruption, and you just talked about the mixing of DNA in this last story. And you think, if we look at those books and it talks about how they sinned with the birds and the beasts and things like this. If you look at the Black Obelisk, we talk about, was it Shalamizer? I can't ever say his name right. The king.
Oh, Shalamander.
His the Black Obelisk that talks about, I think it's the whole story on its his coronation and everything that was brought to him and it kind of his becoming a king. And it shows on the side, if you look, you can find this. You can Google it. You can find this, the images. It shows like lions with human heads and things like this being brought on leashes.
The huge Anzu bird that was his companion.
This stuff is shown there. And you're seeing a mix of DNA. You know, think about the Minotaur. Think about
goat one.
Centaurs, the satyrs, the fawns. You know, these things that we hear about. And actually in the King James Bible uses satyr, uses unicorn, uses these words. But I truly believe that some of these
sirens, Lilith the Screech Owl,
mermaids, yeah. This stuff.
Well, that's what these guys were.
Mermen.
And one that people mermen always neglect and don't talk about, and it blew my mind when I discovered him, but it was Oannes. Oannes was the head of the Apkallu sages. And he was written about specifically and named. And he was around the Persian Gulf. And there's many myths that he would come up from the ocean each day and talk humanity.
I think that we look through mythology and we like to pass stuff off, but we always say that, you know, mythology comes from something. There's always an ounce of truth in there, at least something that they're pulling this from. And you're seeing it right now with everything you're talking about. This is all mythology, but you're seeing how it correlates back to the Bible. We're seeing how that ties back in. And we've talked about this before, that when it says that the everything was totally corrupt on earth, this isn't saying that you know, they just were, that guy, you know what, he hit his wife that day, so it's totally, that's not what they're saying. When we're totally corrupt, we're talking about the blood is corrupt. The DNA has been messed with. The blood is corrupt. This is no longer humanity. This is no longer the animals that, you know, that's why God brought the animals to the ark, because he brought pure, clean. And when he says to Noah that he is Tamim, which we've hit that a bunch of times, I know, but it meant he was pure. It meant that he was, not that he was perfect, because he was not perfect. You can read that story and find out he definitely was not a perfect man. But he was pure in blood. So you see this tie in. It's just amazing how all those pieces tie in, and you're bringing stuff out that I've never heard before, which I think is awesome, because there's so many different tie-ins and so many things that all brings it back to the truth, and it brings it back to the Bible, like you said. And you're seeing this over and over again, that, like, I so believe the Tower of Babel was the kickoff of that, but, you know, that this changed over time with these different gods showing up at different times, but everybody knew the baseline story.
And what is a myth? A myth is a story, but it serves as like a ship on the ocean. It is the vessel that carries something. What's the something that it carries? Information, knowledge, history. So if I just tell you, in 1973 we did this and this person invented that, da 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 da, you might remember it. But if I tell you, in 1973 a huge beast come out of the ocean carrying this round thing with a swirl in the center of it, and light emanated from it, and this beast's name was Thomas Edison. There's truth there. What they do is they make it more fantastical and rememberable, so the important information gets carried through. That's what these myths do. They're just their history and their knowledge and messages sent through time, but just made in a fantastical, memorable way. There's nuggets of truth in all of these. And like you said, they stem from an ancient source.
But I think that actually is a really good point, because you think about it in the context that at that time, especially after the Tower of Babel, you would not have had written language right away in all those different languages. So how else are you going to get these oral traditions if you don't have them memorable? If it's something like I was hearing history in high school and I'm passing out in the back row, sleeping through most of it, you're not going to remember any of that. So you're right. That makes sense. I mean, that I've never thought of it that way, but that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Clear Eyes has an ingredient to moisturize. Remember that guy?
I do. Ben Stein. Bueller.
Yeah.
Bueller. I love that.
But we'll take this one to the kiddos. We're going to go to Polynesia, Maui.
Yep, that movie, what was it called? What was that called?
I think it's called Maui.
Maui, I think.
Was the movie called Maui?
I think so. The Disney movie?
Or something like that.
I know that was the name of the guy, like the main character, the god.
Yeah. Well, see, my kids were older.
I think it was Moana.
Moana, yes.
Because that was the girl.
So I hadn't watched that film. I was not familiar with this guy until I'd done this little, you know, dig here. But he was a demigod. He was a Nephilim. Mm-hmm. And he was a culture hero. But he was also known as the trickster god, who also was a trickster.
Loki.
Loki was a trickster. Prometheus was a trickster. Enki was a trickster. What do all these tricksters have in common? They passed the knowledge, the wisdom. They were the quote-unquote civilizers of mankind. That's your common thread here. But Maui was known for what? Stealing the fire? I mean, gee.
Can't make it up.
You can't make this stuff up. So he was known for stealing the fire for humanity from the underworld. He was also known for fishing up islands out of the water, the abyss, the abuso, with his magic hook. And he also captured the sun to lengthen the days. But these islands are just west of South America. Could this have been Viracocha's next stop?
Did you know that Maui's hook was actually his grandmother's jawbone?
No, I did not.
And presumably he took it after she, you know, had passed. But, I mean, just throwing that out there.
Samson had jawbone.
Sure did. And so did one of the other judges. Or no, it wasn't. He didn't kill him with that. He did something with the Philistines where he killed a bunch too, I remember. But, yeah, Samson went after him with that jawbone.
But the last one I got is you can't have this little trip around the world mythologies without talking about Egypt and Osiris. And here we have another Disney foreshadowing type play going on. You remember the movie The Lion King?
Mm-hmm.
Well, here was this young boy. His father was killed by his brother to usurp him and take the throne. And the boy was cast away but came back and killed his evil uncle and took back the throne. This is the story of Osiris. When you dig into the mythology, it says that Osiris had an evil brother named Set. And Set hated Osiris. But Osiris was another world civilizer. He taught humanity agriculture, math, the planting seasons, music, just all these things that we see through all these stories I've mentioned. Another carbon copy. And for him doing this, the people were said to have loved him exceedingly. And this made Set hate him even more. So Osiris's wife was Isis. Isis was also a giver of knowledge, but her main thing was grain, how to grow grain, what seasons to plant it in, and to harvest and all these things. Well, who is her cognate? Her cognate, with the Greeks anyway, was Demeter. And that's a whole nother rabbit trail. But that's a fascinating rabbit trail because you go down the whole road of Eleusis and the Eleusian mysteries. The drinking of the Kokion and the art of dying before you die and having all this wisdom and stuff given to you. And it's just basically psychedelic trips, but that's just a sidebar. But in this story, Set decides to kill the brother, take him out. But interesting note is Osiris would take off seasons, and he would pack up his ships and would sail and civilize other worlds.
No.
And that Isis, you know, would stand by the shores and wait for him and miss him, but he would be gone for long periods of time civilizing the world. So could Osiris be Quetzalcoatl, Viracocha, and all these different names? And Osiris is depicted with bluish skin, like he was amphibious. But in another correlation with the Sumerian kings list is Meski-Engasher. Meski-Engasher gave up his throne to sail the world and civilize humanity. That he just handed off the kingship. He got bored and said that he just loaded up on his ships and just went off on adventures. But Set decided that he would trick his brother. So he got his brother's measurements and made this box. All kinds of gold inlays, rubies, talked about how beautiful this thing was. And to me, I thought of Pandora's box. I thought of the Ark of the Covenant. And when he came back from one of his civilizing trips, Set threw this grand party, and he had 72 conspirators. According on which translation you read, but there were 70 or 72 nations listed in the Table of Nations. And we've talked about 70 being a complete set. Well, 72 translates to astrology and astronomy. You have this thing called the precession of the equinox. And that's your, you know, your tilt of the axis. And we talked about this in our astronomical episode that we did. But there's houses, right? Mm-hmm. Well, when the summer solstice would rise, wherever it rose, whatever constellation that it was lined up with, that was the house it was in. So on the summer solstice, when the sun rose, if it was in the constellation of Leo, that tells you, when you hear everybody talking about we're in the age of Pisces, the age of Aquarius, that's the house. So if the sun rose on the summer solstice in Leo, you're in the age of Leo. Well, it takes 72 years to move 1 degree. And it takes 1,260 years to move in your houses. So that 72 is an astronomical number. It's basically like the heartbeat of the precession. And for the sun to go through all 12 constellations is what they call a great year. It's just shy of 26,000 years. It's like 25,000, some odd number. Mm-hmm. So here you have Set with the 72 conspirators killing Osiris, the sun. He symbolized the sun. But the contest he had was, and he had the conspirators play along, that whoever could fit into the box could have it as a prize. And it said that they got Osiris drunk on strong wine. Could this be pharmakia, like a mixture of some kind of psychedelic? We don't know. But it said it was a strong drink. It just wasn't wine. And that Osiris was enamored by the box, and he wanted to try. And Isis tried to warn him against it, but he didn't listen. So he laid in the box. He fit perfectly, of course. It was made for him. and closed the box, and the conspirators gathered around and held the box closed. They nailed it closed and sealed it with mortar, threw it into the river. Well, Osiris dies, but he ends up floating down to Babylos. Babylon? Possibly. But he gets wrapped into a tree, a baby tree, and he stays there for so long that the tree wraps around him and covers him. But it says that this tree put off, you know, godly fragrance and had the most beautiful flowers around it and all this stuff, and that the king and queen of Babylos loved this tree so much that they ordered it chopped down and to be made a pillar inside their palace. And Isis goes out and tries to look for him. And this story mirrors Demeter mourning the loss of her daughter, Persephone. So, in both of these stories, I mean, they're the same. Isis goes out and looks, can't find him, she's mourning, ends up finding some kids by the river, and they point her to the palace that the queen had just had a child, and that she could take care of the child there, because that was the work of old women, taking care of children. So she goes, takes the job. There's twins, and one of them was really sickly boy. So she took to him, and at night she done spells and basically bathed the baby in flames, but it didn't hurt it. It was strengthening it, and she was basically going to make this child an immortal. Well, the mother sees it and thinks she's trying to hurt it and comes in, screams and yells. And Isis gets mad, and she's in like a human form disguise and reveals her glory to them and threatens them and calls her an idiot. You know, your kid was going to live forever, but now because of you, it's going to die. And that's the same exact story of Demeter. I thought that was just fascinating. And she orders that she wants the main column in the palace. Cuts open the column, finds the box. Takes Osiris, goes and does some spells to try to reincarnate him. Well, she leaves it by the river, and that was kind of like a Moses foreshadowing to me. Here's this box she leaves by the river, and it was hidden in the reeds, and she goes to get her son, Horus, because she left Horus in the care of someone else. As she's gone, Set returns, sees it, becomes upset, cuts him into 14 pieces, and spreads his body all over the place. So then she has to try to find all the pieces. She finds 13 of the 14. The one that is missing is the penis. So she makes the phallic, the stone penis that you see, the obelisks everywhere. And reanimates him, and he becomes the lord of the underworld, and it is Horus who avenges his father and takes back the throne. I know that was long-winded, but it was just wild how that story laid out, and there was an exact mirror between Isis and Demeter and the whole foundling child coming back and avenging his father's death like the Lion King.
That actually is interesting. I wonder if somehow you can tie that into Moses the same way, though, because Moses ended up coming and he ends up killing an Egyptian, you know, at that point when he leaves Egypt and he figures out who he is, and because he's basically avenging his people.
Mm-hmm. He was a foundling. That's what they call these. Mm-hmm. They're foundlings.
That's interesting.
And you can just go for days with, I mean, there's thousands of these stories that's identical, cookie cutter, like all these others.
And they just tie in. And you can go through and look at, everybody's got a flood myth. Everybody has the creation myth, how it happened. Everybody has, and I mean, someone who was, like you said, the one that saved humanity. Everybody has these things. And it's not hard to see that the correlation, that it happened. It happened. But the cool part that I think we can see is that we see it's, you know, ultimately the Bible just being proved right over and over and over and over again. I just love it. It just, all these things do, and this is where some people will say, you know, oh, why would you look at the, why would you look at these things? That's different this, that's different that. You know, we talked about it with Alberino, and, you know, always be founded in your gospel. Be founded in your gospel first. But after that, start digging. And when you start digging and seeing all these other things and all the correlations, all it does is strengthen my faith. All it does is say, yep, you're going the right direction. To me, it's so cool to see that we can find that biblical truth in everywhere we look. Even in pagan religions, we find the truth of the Bible. That blows me away. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say to follow after the, because you no, the pagan religions, they're pagan, they're not good. Mm-hmm. But we can see that it's just a bastardization of the Bible. It's a bastardization of what, who God is, who Jesus is. Mm-hmm. So we can see all they're trying to do is copycat. And I think that's awesome. I think it's so cool that we can take that and use that, just like God uses crazy things and things that don't seem like they make sense for his greatness, for his glory. We can see that in all these stories.
And it, you know, just, you know, like it says, study to show thyself approved. Yes, these are deceptions, but you need to know the deceptions. Because when non-believers or atheists come at you and be like, oh, well, what about Mithras? He was a dying and resurrecting God that had disciples and a Last Supper and said that he would come back and judge all humanity and the ones that followed him and ate his bread and drank his wine, that which was his body and his blood, would live forever with him and his Father in paradise, and that he made many mansions, you know. And that's older than your Jesus Christ story. And if you're not looking into these things, you're just like, that's a lie. You don't look too intelligent, and you're not going to win souls. Mm-hmm. So if you know these stories, then you know the deception. You know where certain things do mirror the gospel. But then you also know the because most of the time the deception or twist is really small. But you know it, and you can call it out.
Yep. I 100% agree. 100%.
And if you're already a believer, like you said, it strengthens your faith. It validates it. It's no longer just a story you heard since you were a little kid. No, there's truth and evidence behind it.
No doubt. Well, I love looking into this stuff. I think Justin really, really loves looking into this stuff. And Ben, he just likes looking at me, apparently. But...
I seen him winking earlier.
I know. Worry about him over there.
I'm glad this table's big. I know his leg can't reach yours.
No, he can't.
Well, I don't know. He's slouching pretty good.
Let me try to reach over.
Well, listen, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. This stuff, we're all learning together. We're all digging together. We hope that listening to this encourages you to dig into your word, to dig into, find that biblical truth, and just... keep on that right path. Hope it strengthens your faith. And as always,
keep digging.
Boom.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to the Dig Bible Podcast. If you would, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. Comment. Tell us where you're from, because that would be cool. Comment, subscribe, like, hit the thumbs up. Share with your friends. Share the love. Till next time. See you later.
Hey guys, this is Steve from the Dig Bible Podcast. I really hope you guys are enjoying the content, but also the sound quality. It's drastically improved since I handed that duty over to the handcrafted audio. If you've enjoyed the quality of the show and have any audio or editing needs, reach out to Jason at thehandcraftedaudio@gmail.com. And as always, keep digging.